Welcome to the SMI Bulldog, where we talk about serious mental illness, advocacy, and public policy. Brian Black here with you. Joining us today, and it is an honor to speak with you, author Pete Early, author of the book Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. Pete, thank you so much for being here today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Brian.
Well, I really enjoy this book, and it's something that is on a lot of people's bookshelves, myself included. And it is something that I wanted to have you on because I had alluded to this prior to us going on air, is I initially started my podcast in a more general focus for media and mental illness and mental health. And I was not aware until fairly recently, the whole other area of advocacy, whereby it's either a parent or guardian or other, you know, family member who's assisting for someone who is not aware that they're sick. And I don't want to sound like there's no way of this sounding not sounding naive, so I'll just say it. I'm surprised that there is this almost like a subculture. I don't know if subculture be the right word, but do you know what I mean? It's almost like there's these two areas of advocacy, and the two areas of advocacy don't seem to be in much conversation with each other.
Exactly. You know, I was shocked when I did my book. Of course, one of the main focuses of my book is that people with serious mental illnesses are ending up in jails and prisons, and they're becoming, you know, we've all heard it ad nauseum, the largest public mental facilities, and why that's wrong. And I was shocked because I had people sending me notes saying, how dare you write about this? We want to be treated the same as anyone else. We have no sympathy. If you break the law, you need to be in jail. Just because you have a mental illness doesn't mean that you should be treated differently. And I was going like, hey, read the book. We're talking about people who are locked up for 5 years because they're psychotic and they shove someone at a bus stop and there's no place to send them. So they end up in jail. But I think basically I use this rule of thumb on one end. If you want to go on the one side, you have the Christian Science or Scientology people who don't believe in it, don't want to have anything to do with it. And then you move over a little more and you have like Mad in America and Robert Whittaker, who really questions whether drugs are really helpful. And they present a view like that. Then you move more to the center and you get like NAMI, National Alliance for Mental Illness. And that's more, started out as a parent group actually. And then you move on the other side of that is Mental Health America, which started out as a consumer group. And then you hit Treatment Advocacy Center on the other end. And so you kind of have these voices and everyone is dug in on their position. And as you said, it's unfortunate because everybody should get together and talk for the benefit of all. The question is, you know, what's that benefit? And I've come to believe it's individual. You have to judge each individual and see what those needs are. And of course, the big lightning rod is assisted outpatient treatment and forced medication.
Correct. And for those who don't know, and I've been very open about this, is the more that I'm learning about AOT, AKA involuntary commitment, AKA other court order treatment, whatever terminology or verbiage, the more that I learn about it, the more that I am open to learning more about it, and the more that it really is the viable option in a lot of cases. So that's, you know, I support more dialogue learning about it. For example, I know there's people who do not believe in, and I'm going to try to say this word, anosognosia. Yeah, but I mean, just on a, I mean, I don't think it's terribly outside the realm of possibility that someone can be unaware that they're sick. So if there's someone raising objections, that person obviously is aware of their condition. I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility. And we see this with dementia. We see this with traumatic brain injury. We see this with schizophrenia, where someone is unaware that they're sick. So I have a hard time with many of the objections about it, because whether you want to call it the A word, or whether, whatever word you want to call it, I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility that there are people who, for whatever reason, are not aware that they're sick.
I don't think you'll find many people who will actually argue that. My son, when he was psychotic, had no clue that he was ill. The problem, and when you get into the weeds, is that how do you address that person? And, you know, AOT is stepping in and saying, we are going to make you go to treatment, or we're going to provide treatment for you. And of course, that opens up another level, because if you have someone under an AOT order, and they have to meet certain requirements, you have to have a history of violence, a history of going off and becoming psychotic, blah, blah, blah. But the bottom line is, you know, you have to provide the services. But the fight really, look, we've always said in this country that there is a point where we're going to step in. So the argument is not whether or not you should step in. The question is, when will you step in? And the argument boils down to, is the dangerous criteria good enough, a good enough marker for deciding that? And a lot of parents don't think so. And I don't want my son's civil rights violated. I want safeguards. But to me, using dangerousness, which Arizona and other states use, is ridiculous, because no one can predict dangerousness. Mm-hmm. And states have tried to get around this by saying, okay, gravely disabled, unable to care for themselves, etc. But a lot of it goes down to, I believe, a lot of this discussion could really be put aside if we had more services. And again, that's why I'm happy about peers and others, where you try a warmer approach, an earlier approach. But no, you know, after I did my book, I spent 6 months on the streets with the homeless in Washington, D.C. And I'll give you three quick examples. There was one guy who was under a bridge, who had no clue what day it was. He was as psychotic and sick as could be, living under a bridge, literally eating out of trash cans. Another guy was fine and carried on fine conversations until he started talking about the masers, which were those CIA beams reading his thoughts. A third guy had lost his job, his marriage, and everything else because he was bipolar, and he went up to Atlantic City and blew all his money. Now, under the law, which of those people would you AOT? Well, I have no problem taking the guy off the street who's psychotic and living there on the street. And I believe that if you AOT'd him and got him services, that in the end, he'd probably thank you. But are you going to AOT the guy who simply thinks that there's masers? Are you going to AOT the guy who's because of his bipolar, does that? And under the law, you really couldn't AOT any of them, because none of them were doing anything dangerous. It's not illegal to be psychotic and live under a bridge. So that's why I'm not a fan of the dangerous criteria, because it's so harsh. I mean, here in Fairfax County, Virginia, we have three judges who literally, you have to have a knife at someone's throat to get them to admit that somebody's a danger to themselves or other. And, you know, I think the dangerous criteria is ridiculous. I think we need a better criteria for intervening when it's appropriate. And then, of course, intervening in the less inclusive way. But a lot of times that is, you know, trying to get somebody in order and getting them into treatment.
Correct. Now, one thing I do want to clarify, and you address this in your book as well, but I just want to clarify for those listening, If you're in therapy right now, if you're taking your meds or not, with doctors, you know, keeping your doctor in the loop, if you're aware of your own treatment, that's not what you're talking about. You're talking about those who are divorced or removed from any semblance of their own recovery. So I just want to clarify that for those listening, that yeah, you're Brian, not. You're,
I'm going to even stew the pot even more, mm-hmm. make it more complicated. People have the idea that if you are psychotic, you are psychotic 24/7. And that, you know, I've met a lot of people on the street who that is their illness. They've been sick for so long that I think they've actually suffered brain damage and they are that way. But for instance, like my son, the problem is that, for instance, a lot of parents face this is, the like my son was sitting in front of a TV with tin foil wrapped around his head. Sure, the CIA was reading his thoughts. But when I took him to an emergency room, the doctor asked him, for instance, what does it mean to cry over spilt milk? Who is the president? And he could answer those questions because, and it always used to amaze me, Brian, when I spent 10 months in the jail in Miami-Dade following people with mental illness through the system, right? And you could bring somebody who is psychotic off the street, and I mean fluidly psychotic, bring them into jail, and there were two things they knew. They knew what medications they were on and what they didn't want. Don't give me Haldol, don't give me Haldol. And the other thing was interesting is they kind of had this nature of who, this sense about who really wanted to help them and who was gonna brutalize them. And I always found that interesting. I have no explanation for it, but they seemed to know if someone was actually interested in it or not. What I've come to believe, and it fits for me, and it may not fit for everyone, especially parents of somebody who's homeless on the streets. But with my son, I had to switch from being a parent to becoming a partner. And I remember Tom Insel, National Institutes of Mental Health, said, the trick is to, when someone's lucid, get to them, find out what they're trying to accomplish, join them in that and try to move them to a point where they're willing to accept some kind of treatment.
Correct. Now, one thing that I really appreciate about your book, and those who have it probably not saying anything that they don't know, but I really appreciate that you have a proverbial timeline early in your book, right, as far as different. And one thing I do want to take issue with is I see a lot of movies. I mean, a lot of movies. And they're oddly enough, I don't know how this is even possible, but I have a very few number of movies that really, really offend me for whatever reason, whether content or theme or whatnot. One of the very few movies that offends me to this day is the movie that shows up on mental health timelines, namely One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. You know, which you correctly state in the book was one of the movies that won the big four, you know, picture, director, actor, and actress. Capra's movie, It Happened One Night, and Silence of the Lambs being the others. But that movie, I don't know about the book, but the movie has probably done irreparable harm in a lot of people's image of mental illness. Because if you think about, you know, and it's a credit to the film, you know, in some ironic way. I mean, it's a good movie. I'm not going to deny that it's a good movie. But as far as the harm it's done, as far as stereotypes and stigma, and you say mental illness and hospitalization, people immediately think of Jack Nicholson in that movie. They immediately think of Nurse Ratched. And I think in that respect, that movie has done irreparable harm in a lot of ways. You make mention later in the book about the whole segment of those with mental illness as like throwaway people. And so much of the caricature of them is due in large part to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
You have to understand why that movie did so much damage and what it was initially about. I mean, I've talked to Michael Douglas. who was the one behind it. I talked to the doctor, in fact, became a really good friend with the doctor who plays himself in the movie and got everybody into the mental hospital, actual mental hospital. That book initially was written as a, and came out of the 60s and 70s as an anti-big government type book. And they chose mental hospitals kind of as the ultimate scene in that. What happened was that the focus became all on the evils of state hospitals at a time when state hospitals really had across the country, you know, you gotta look at the history of state hospitals. I mean, Dorothea Dix in the 1800s got them started because people were languishing in jails and on the streets. And so they were set out to be benevolent, but they grew and grew and grew and grew. And of course the government cut all the funding for it. And so that movie hit at an exact time when Kennedy called for community centers, and it really helped him push forward the deinstitutionalization effort to close all these state hospitals. Now, what people need to understand is what was really behind that was money. States had to shell out lots of money. These places, if you read my book, you'll read about it in Florida, the horrible hospital there where people were stripped of all their clothes. They brought clothes in a bin in the morning. People fought for clothes. They had windows that neighbors could look through, and they saw all these naked people, and they said, you know, you got to do something. So they spray painted all the windows black. They didn't give people toothbrushes. They just put a can out. They didn't give women hygiene project. I mean, it was horrific. So that was where a lot of these hospitals were. And so that movie crystallized that. And as you so wisely pointed out, it also crystallized these people like Jack Nicholson. You know, it's interesting because we've closed down all these state hospitals and we've really limited them. And you can tie that directly to the increase of people in jails and prisons because we've never developed a community system that can handle. And there's arguments to be made with, can a community system really handle someone with a serious mental illness, which is what you're focused on, or do they need some kind of locked facility? One last comment here, and then I'll be quiet. We still have state hospitals, or we still have mental hospitals. I mean, the trick is they're only for the wealthy. And what I mean by that is if in Virginia, if you get committed to a state hospital, you're going to spend 3 days before they shove you out the door. Or if you're really sick, 20 days, okay? Unless you're violent. All right. I did a book with Glenn Close's sister, Jessie, who has mental illness. Her son had schizophrenia. They sent him to McLean Hospital, which is used to be around 20, 22,000 a month to pay for. He spent 2 years there before they finally got the meds tirated. They got everything set up and he could deal with the schizophrenia. So it's not a hospital that's evil. And that's what came out of Kuznets. The idea that these hospitals in themselves were evil places. It's that a poorly financed hospital and one that has a nurse ratchet is evil. But we have hospitals. That's what people don't realize, but you just got to be rich enough to afford them.
Correct. And that touches upon something that I've noticed in, I don't know if this observation is correct or not, but from my vantage point, it seems like, and I'll, as an example, there's a group Treatment Advocacy Center. Treatment right. Advocacy Center and many of its contemporaries will only engage contact with lawmakers, with policymakers. And that is something that completely, and the reason I have a trouble with that is because what's the one thing everybody learned in junior high civics class? That we, the people, are the government. And so I have a problem with that. When someone decides we're only going to talk with people who are already in elected office. Because what that means, think about what that means. What that means is, look at the former governor of New York. That is someone who you would have people, you know, kissing his ring, so to speak. if he would end the IMD exclusion, if he would do this and that, when he's not allegedly misbehaving with congressional staffers. So I have a problem with that when there is this priority given to elected officials who were only elected, depending on where they are, in a 2-year term or a 4-year term or a 6-year term, at the expense of constituents who are not elected, who are ignored and pushed aside. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? That's what I have a hard time with, when it's someone who's not a senator, someone who's not a congressman, who is essentially ignored and invisible because they're not in that position of power. It seems to me to be antithetical to everything that our representative system in the U.S. should be about.
Yeah, well, you know, I write about the Treatment Advocacy Center in my book, and I have several very good friends there. I imagine, I can't speak for them and won't speak for them, that they are zeroing in on the people they most want to influence. And, you know, it is interesting, though, that TAC, Treatment Advocacy Center, is the only major mental health organization that doesn't take any drug or pharmacy money, and in fact is supported wholly by, it's mostly parents who have serious mentally ill kids. But you have to look at TAC's history. It was created by Fuller Torrey to get AOT laws passed, starting with Kindra's Law in New York. And what they learned was, and DJ Jaffe, a friend of mine who died, but wrote a book called Insane Consequences. He was on their board. And what they realized is, if you went to a state legislature and you said, look, the dangerous criteria is ridiculous, we need to change it, we need to get, there are people with serious mental illness who don't know they're sick, and we need to force them or get them into treatment, that they didn't get anywhere. And what they discovered with Kindra's Law, Kindra was about Kindra Webdale, a beautiful young lady who got pushed in front of a subway and died, was that if you picked a case like that where it showed that someone was psychotic, was dangerous, and did this, you could get the general public to go, oh, wow, we need to do something about that. So it's unfortunate, but what happened then was they had Laura's Law in California, and they would pick these cases because those were the most effective at getting assisted outpatient treatment put in place. And unfortunately, that by the nature of what was effective, it also created a dynamic that everybody with mental illness was dangerous. And so that's just part of the conundrum we're in. Advocacy Center has switched more to IMD because under Trump, they won the AOT battle. Yeah. I mean, SAMHSA put all kinds of money into AOT.
Yeah, and SAMHSA, that is the, for those who might be listening, you're talking about the federal agency.
Yeah, it's the federal agency that doles out millions and millions of dollars.
Yeah, because again, one of the things that, and I, like I said, and I support looking more into AOT and treatment options. So I definitely am supportive of that. The thing that I have a problem with is there tends to be a lot of contradictory legislative actions. Ergo, there is legislation in Arizona, for example, where teachers are essentially under attack if they give the wrong book to a student. If there is COVID remediation that's taken in school, and there's blowback against it from different parties in the legislature. So on one hand, there's late stage crisis attention to the serious mental illness. But on the other hand, there tends to be a very contradictory posture as it pertains to our schools and the early intervention piece of it, for example. That seems to me to be more than a little hypocritical, whereby we only care about it once they're arrested, once they've got the court order treatment, then we care. But it's the whole thing about nobody cares about crazy people. What about the kids at the elementary level in school? When you've got parents attacking school boards who do not want suicide prevention talked about in schools, who do not want any mental health taught in schools. It seems to be contradictory and conflicting messaging. I don't know if that's true where you are, but it seems to be the case in Arizona.
Oh, absolutely. And my wife's a teacher, so no, I mean, we have the Virginia governor who just got elected saying that parents need to have a greater voice in school boards. I mean, that's a real popular thing right now. But we know that early intervention is important. We know schools are a good place to identify kids who are struggling or have mental issues. And the problem is that when we identify folks like that and don't do it, you know, haphazardly, you have to have safeguards in place. There are no services for them. And there are no services until people, I mean, you're in Arizona, you have the perfect example because you have where Gabby Gifford got shot. And if you look into that case where the Gabby Gifford was shot along with a state senator and other people, if you look into that, you will discover that the parents of the young man who was the shooter tried to get help for that, their son. They reached out, they complained. And what happens is everybody says, well, are they dangerous? And that's what happened with my case with my son. I took him to the hospital. He was psychotic. He was threatening to kill himself. But when the doctor met with him, he came across as being, you know, delusional, but there was no law against that. And they said, bring him back after he tries to harm someone or harm yourself. And, you know, that's the criteria. And then he went out and 24 or 48 hours later, broke into a stranger's house to take a bubble bath.
Yeah.
Luckily, they weren't home or he would have been shot. So, you know, again, I go back to the dangerous criteria, lack of services, lack of beds, lack of treatment. You know, we do have some positives. We have telemedicine, which has really helped a lot.
Definitely.
And in Arizona, in Phoenix, in fact, you have a company there that's really developed the 988. 988 is going to become the 911 for mental health and drug crises.
Exactly. That's rolling out later this year.
Right.
I believe.
And we'll see how it does. But the idea is you call this number and you have an expert who triages your call and says, oh, and in a perfect world can say, oh, I can get you in to see Dr. Early tomorrow at 2 o'clock, or wow, you sound like you need a mobile crisis response team to come to your house, if they exist, and do a diagnosis, or oh, this is a case where you need to be hospitalized and, you know, get service in, not the police. Use the police as a last resort.
Right. I almost forgot. I did want to mention, you did mention One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is one of my least favorite movies.
Right.
But you also you also mentioned one of my favorite movies. I absolutely love the movie The Snake Pit. The movie has not aged well, and I'll be the first to admit that. So it's not, I don't think it's a best movie, but it's one of my favorite movies because it's very much in the mold of like old school Hollywood melodrama.
Yeah.
It's very comparable to the Alfred Hitchcock movie Spellbound.
Yeah.
Not quite, but very similar insofar as subject matter. But Snake Pit is one of my favorite movies. I love the movie. I've seen it, I don't know how many times. I've got it on Blu-ray. I've got it on DVD. That is one of my favorite movies.
I thought, Brian, you were going to mention A Beautiful Mind, which I absolutely do not like.
I am happy to hear you say that. I am not a fan of that movie either.
Well, it's very offensive to parents because the basic message is if you love someone enough and you really care about them enough, they can beat their mental illness. And while compassion is certainly in there, do you know how offensive that is to parents who have a kid who's wandering around the streets psychotic and they can't intervene because they're not dangerous? You know, which sets them up to be beaten, abused, or arrested. And so it's nice Hollywood, but when you're dealing with somebody with a serious mental illness, you know, just saying, oh, if you just love them more is nonsense.
Yeah, exactly. So, but again, I did want to just, you know, acknowledge that, because anytime there's an element of media, because that does play a large role in public perception of mental illness. You know,
it's changed over the years. I mean, yeah. it went from Psycho to Silver Lining Playbook, mm-hmm. which, you know, shows the transition. And you're seeing now, I mean, it for a while, bipolar disorder was the soup of the day, you know. Every TV show had someone who had bipolar disorder on it and, you know, who did the mood swings. And those were all good and educational as long as they were done responsibly and not the old Psycho way, you know. But I got to tell you, if I had to do over, I wouldn't have named my book Crazy. It refers to our system. But that word itself is stigmatizing. So
it is. You live in London. It is. Yeah. So that is. And when I mentioned the name of the book at the top of the podcast, I did give the subtitle of it also, so that it wasn't living the word only by itself. But now, is there anything that I did not ask you about that you wanted to mention that I?
Brian, I appreciate, because like me, you have discovered that there's such a range of voices in the mental health community. And what you have to understand is that most of the public doesn't care. I mean, unless you're affected by mental health, you aren't going to buy my book. You're not going to buy the other books, you know. And most of the public out there is just floating along and has 10. I was a reporter at the Washington Post. I covered deinstitutionalization, but I had no idea about what the tragedy we're living in this country right now, and the people who are suffering because of our lack of helping people and the cost involved in jailing people. I had no idea about that. And somehow we have to reach those people. We have to wake them up. We have to, and to do that, we really would be better off if instead of fighting among ourselves for scraps, we united and agreed on certain things and push that agenda. The problem is, you know, it's difficult to do that with such different views.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do want to thank you for speaking with me. I've been fortunate to find people who do agree to talk with me. There are, and I think I've alluded to this prior to us going on mic, is there are some, you know, voices supportive of AOT, which I support AOT in a lot of cases. I'm not against it. I support it. Who seem to think that I'm a horrible person, and I'm because I think I mentioned to you I was cyber mobbed, and there are still to this day people who have me blocked, who have me canceled, who think I'm a horrible person. And it's like, okay, so you're essentially, many people are pushing away people who want to help because I do care, but I want to be, you know, have my, you know, peace of mind. If I reach out and someone kicks me in the teeth and pushes me away and says that I'm harassing them, if I just simply reach out, then I'm going to, you know, binge watch whatever crap's on Netflix and not give a flip about this. So that's been my experience. Is there? It's either been people who are receptive to me helping, or people who say, "Get the bleep away from me! You know, you horrible person! Don't ever contact me again." It's either been one of those two scenarios. It's never been lukewarm. It's either been people who are open and receptive to me helping, and people who are either, you know, get the bleep away from me, quit bothering me. And I don't, the second one just makes no sense to me, because if someone's clamoring for help, you know, end the IMD exclusion, give more beds, the logical next step would not be to kick someone in the teeth if they reach out to help. It would be to, okay, here's what we need help with. And yet I have not had a uniformly positive experience when I've reached out to help.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. And I will assure you though, first of all, don't take it personally. And second, you know, I think extremism on either side is bad. But
yeah.
I can assure you that if you come out and say, I'm pro AOT, I think AOT is the best thing ever, you will then be faced with people who will want to disassociate from you and be angry at you because they see that as murder and et cetera. All you have to do is look at Fuller Tory or DJ Jappy and how the anti-AOT people, you know, consider them demons. So
yeah.
It goes on both sides. And unfortunately, you know, there to me, AOT is a tool, like so many tools. To me, it's in many ways, it's kind of a tool that often should be the last resort. But, you know, if you say that, AOT is a lightning rod. And it's like, you know, people are either, you know, it's like you're either pro-Trump or anti-Trump, and there's no middle ground. And that's the way it is. It's too bad. It really is.
Bad. Yeah. And I know, and you know, and hopefully many people listening know, will know that you're not, you know, calling for people to, you know, lock people up and, you know, no, that's not what you're talking about at all. And I would just wish more people would realize that. It would make things so much simpler if people would simply realize that.
No, not in people who care about mental health care deeply and they have strong views and trying to navigate that path, you're going to offend somebody. It's just the bottom line. I mean, there are people who are anti-medication. There are people who don't believe, you know, I mean, look at Tom Cruise jumping him down the couch. He knows everything. And there is no such thing as, you know, schizophrenia. Well, obviously, he hadn't dealt with many people with schizophrenia.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But I definitely want to be part of the solution. And I definitely want to have more dialogues like this so people can know that, you know, whatever crap they see online or whatever, you know, it's to get to the root of it. And I appreciate the work you do. And I appreciate, you know, the opportunity to speak with me today. So
thank you very much, Brian.
So if people can.
Can I leave you with one quick
story? Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So years ago, I wrote a piece for USA Today, and it was one of the paragraphs in it is that people with mental illness are not to blame. It's an illness, folks, just like any other illness. And USA Today published it. 3 years later or so, a mother wrote to me, and she said, I want to tell you a story. My son was homeless on the streets for 20 years. And he finally walked into a shelter and asked for help. And when they emptied his pockets and were taking his clothes and all that kind of stuff to give him new clothes, they found a newspaper clipping where it had been circled, people with mental illness are not to blame, just over and over and over again. And she said, I think that that really is what was the emphasis for him to go get help. Now, I'm not telling you that story, Brian, to say, oh, wasn't that great? I'm telling you because you're doing a podcast. You don't know who your words are going to reach and how they may help someone. I mean, I never thought when I wrote that that this guy would read it and feel that way. So thank you for what you're doing and thank you for spreading the word and thank you for being open-minded and having me on.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much. And thank you, those of you at home or wherever you may be. Stay safe, everyone. And talk to you next time. Bye.